welcome our first speaker on stage. The talk will be about protecting the wild, and I'll hand over to her. Please give her a warm round of applause.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction. My name is Jutta Buschbaum. I'm an evolutionary biologist. That is my background. I did do my PhD at the University of Chicago, working on little fungi that live in symbiosis with algae and form colorful rocks on colorful crusts on rocks. I then did a postdoc in bioinformatics, and after that moved back into organismal biology, working in forest genetics. And the 10 years I worked in forest genetics, for the first time I encountered questions that were with regard to application. And I found out that actually moving from research to application is not trivial. So what I'm going to present is a high-tech way using genomic data to protect biodiversity in a way that you can actually reach application and use conservation genomic tools. So this summer, the draft of the report of the Intergovernmental Science Policy Panel for Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services came out and had its results were quite warning. It stated that around 1 million animal and plant species are currently stated, and of those, half of those species are already dead species walking. So because due to the destruction of their habitats or habitat deterioration, they are not able to reproduce in a sustainable way anymore. A third of the total species extinction risk to date has arisen in the last 25 years. And just to give you an idea about the relation we are talking about currently the rate of the extinction risk is already at least tens to hundreds of times higher than it has averaged over the past 10 million years. And within these 10 million years, there were the ice ages, for example. And most of the extinction risk is due to the factor of land and sea use change. The report also talks about that we already seem to have transgressed a proposed precautionary planetary boundary, which means within the boundary we have a stable biological system, but having transgressed it, we might already be in a transition to a new state that we have no way to find out how the state is going to look like. So all of these facts that the report is stating are actually pretty negative, and I was quite happy to read that they also present that there are actually people who do better than most of us. And they point out that many practices of indigenous people in local communities actually conserve and sustain wild and domesticated biodiversity quite well. And today, a high proportion of the remaining terrestrial biodiversity lies in areas managed and held by indigenous people. And these ecosystems are more intact and less rapidly declining. So we have examples of lifestyles that actually do better than most of us. And I know the solutions won't be simple and it won't be easy to get there, but we can look to what these people do better than we do. All of this sounds, it's a global report and it sounds kind of like far away, like probably somewhere in the tropics, but actually threats to biodiversity happen also directly in front of our own front doors. This summer, a paper came out from two colleagues from the University of Greifswald who had analyzed a long-term data set about leaf beetles, and they were asking if we already have a decline of leaf beetles in Central Europe. So they compiled a long-term data set of leaf beetle observations for Central Europe, starting from 1900 now to 2017, so spanning 120 years. And what they find is that systematic reports on leaf beetles and leaf beetle observations are increasing during this time span, and but despite the fact that we have, like in the last two decades, we had very high numbers of reports and observations for leaf beetles, the number of species, the orange line, is declining. It's slightly declining, but the question is this real or not? And what was most worrisome to the authors is that in the data set, the number of species here in orange that were having more reports was declining, while the number of species that showed less reports than before is expanding. So these kind of long-term data sets are very hard to interpret, and many factors can contribute to those patterns, and it's not clear if this pattern is statistically significant. But if you take a step back and consider your background knowledge, your prior knowledge about the state of the world, do you see, like, how does the current state look like? Does it look rather good or rather, worrisome? And then, with that knowledge, tell me that these results are an artifact or a bias. I'm worried that once we have a statistical significant signal in this data set, it will be already too late. So right now I've been talking about beetles, leaf beetles, and beetles are the largest group within insects with about 400,000 species. Leaf beetles are a large family of about 50,000 species, and which are worldwide distributed. And here in Germany, we have over 470 leaf beetle species. So how do we actually know how many species there are and who actually counted all these species? And that is the task of the taxonomists. Taxonomy is the science of naming and defining, including circumscribing and classifying groups of biological organisms on the basis of shared characters. So one could have the picture of some woman with a funny hat running over a meadow catching like butterflies, or some guy, mushroom hunter, crawling through the forest trying to find mushrooms. And it's true, as biodiversity scientists, we spend a lot of time outdoors. And on the other hand, taxonomy is a high-tech science today. So taxonomists actually take up new technological tools and developments to help them identify and describe, understand the species. So taxonomists actually are often experts in, for example, microscopy, morphometrics, biochemistry, even proteomics and genomics. So throughout the talk, I'm going to compile this list of people and experts we are going to need to protect biodiversity if we are, want to do this on the basis of genomic data. Right now, the list is quite empty. The first entry is taxonomists, but that will change quickly. And taxonomists are a subgroup of evolutionary biologists, mostly. So I told you that taxonomists and biodiversity scientists take up technology. And so as soon as computers came about and the internet started, people started to use that to compile information about species. And today we have several global resources available for at the species level and above the species level. So we have biodiversity scientists were among the first who defined biodiversity information standards. We have a global catalog of life, a list of all named species. The Global Biodiversity Information Facility has the aim to bring together information from different sources, and they are compiling, producing these wonderful maps. This is leaf beetles, all the records about leaf beetles that we have in the world. And it looks like as if leaf beetles are highly associated with third world economics. However, that is clearly is an artifact. And it just shows that we need many more taxonomists and biodiversity scientists all over the world to find and identify leaf beetles. So we also need biodiversity informaticians to help us compile global lists and distribute knowledge. So far I have been talking about species, which is a simplification. The question is, what are species actually? And so we need to talk about genetic diversity within and between species. And I'm going to do so using GULS, which most of us might know. Here in Europe, we have two large GULS of the genus Larus. One is in the front, the lighter gray one is our silver mover, and in the back is our herrings mover, the darker one. And I'm going to use German names because the English names go crosswise and it's completely confusing. So I will stick with the German names. Here in Europe, these two species seem to be really fine species because they barely interbreed, so they don't hybridize. However, if you take a step back and look at the genus in general, you see that the species of the genus are distributed kind of ring-wise around the Arctic. And so the idea is that, say, during the Ice Age, all of this area was glaciated, and the gulls retreated to refuging here near the Caspian Sea. And then after the ice retreated, the gulls moved back north. One branch moved into Europe, forming our herrings mover, and another branch then moved counterclockwise around the Arctic, producing different morphotypes, different species, crossed the Bering Strait, and then into North America. There, the dark blue one is the, I'm simplifying the equivalent of our European silver mover, the American silver mover. Then the idea is that some individual crossed back to Europe and formed our European silver mover. And while all of these species here are interbreeding, so they hybridize, only when this ring is closed, those two species don't interbreed anymore. And the big question is, are we actually dealing with one single species? Or are we dealing with different species that just happen to hybridize more or less? The question is not trivial because it has consequences for protection. If we are dealing with one single species, all the golds in Eurasia could go extinct. And it wouldn't matter because we still would have the golds in North America. However, if we have different species in all these areas, we would need to protect individuals or the species on a regional level and protect all of these different species. So to investigate this question about do we have different species and what were the evolutionary processes and histories that brought about the species, a group of scientists investigated that using DNA sequences. And here on the left you have the model, the theoretical model of the ring species. And here on the right you have reality. And the scientists found that reality is always much more complex. So for example, they found two refugia, or they proposed two refugia. But what they found was that genetic diversity was correlated with those species or morphotypes. And so what that also means that genetic diversity is correlated with geographic origin. What we learn from these type of analysis is we learn about evolutionary processes and history, about variability and differentiation, about gene flow and migration, about speciation processes, which we all need to understand our species, which will allow us to protect them. So we need evolutionary biologists who do phylogenetics and population genetics. So once we found out that one can use genetic diversity to infer geographic origin because genetic diversity is correlated with geography, people immediately said, okay, we can use that for conservation applications. And it's also we learned that it is unclear what is a species. Species boundaries are unclear, and some species have huge distribution ranges, which different clusters of variability within this huge range. So we know that we need to protect within species genetic diversity, which means that we need to understand within species population structure. And we need to build useful and reliable models of population structure. These models are actually required for all of our applications. They are required for monitoring, for example, for conservation strategies, for functional adaptation and adaptability, questions of producibility of different provenances, the impact of management regimes, breeding strategies, and also for enforcement applications. From the studies I showed you before with the gulls, we also know that we need to approach the question of a population structure on a distribution range-wide scale. So here's a map produced by U4Gene, the European Network for Forest Reproductive Material, for one of our native oaks, sessile oak. And the dots are the sites for conservation, genetic conservation units. And so that is that is one strategy how to represent within species genetic diversity and how to sample it. And you can see this is a hypothetical example, but we likely will see a gradient from west to east, or might see one at this scale. Then once we have these kind of global data sets, we can go to the fine scale and maybe, for example, do a national genetic monitoring. And we will find much finer scale gradients. We also will find, especially for forest trees, outliers, so forest stands that don't fit the usual pattern. And that is because forest reproductive material has been moved around a lot, and so these lighter or darker dots are is material that was moved to Germany from the outside. And we only will identify these outliers if we have the whole reference data set. If we don't have the whole reference data set, we might not identify these outliers, stands with a different history. Or in a worst case, these outliers might actually bias our gradients, and we are always talking about very slight gradients. So it's easy to bias these gradients, dilute them, so we actually won't get the results we need. To compile these kind of reference data, that's huge collaborative efforts, because people need to go out there into the field and collect the reference samples, and that might be scientists, that might be people from local communities, citizen scientists, managers, owners, government officials who provide background information, maps, distribution information, and also in many parts of the world they might protect the people who are actually collecting the samples. And it might be conservation activists and NGOs. So once the samples have been collected, they need to be stored somewhere and for the long term, and the information needs to be databased. And that is the work of scientific collections, which are mostly at natural history museums, and there the samples are processed. They're organized in a way that you can find them again, and all the metadata is entered, which curators do, collection managers, preparators, technical staff at the scientific collections. So once we have these kind of data sets, large-scale data sets, what are we actually doing with them? So the foundation for all of our applications is population structure, and there specifically population assignment. So so the process is that we first we decide on a question and design our project accordingly that we can answer the question. Then we need to infer the population structure model and optimize it. In the next step, we need to check if our model actually is good enough for application, because we might have found the best model, but it might not still not be good enough for application. So we need to test that, and that is the step of population assignment or predictive assignment. And then in the end, we want to test our hypothesis. Are the two stands different, or does an individual come from stand A or from stand B? And here, we identify error rates and accuracy. So this whole process is very statistical. And so the analysis of these reference data, they need to be accompanied by biostatisticians who can tell us how to analyze our data. So what is the state of the art right now? What kind of geographic resolution do we actually get with non-model species currently? And I'm going to present the example of an African timber tree species, which is a very valuable timber. It's one example, but basically all results for species who have large distribution ranges and are continuously distributed and are also long, as a longer lived, are very similar. So these kind of results seem to be species independent. So the species are Milicia regia and Excelsia, African teak, which cannot be grown in plantations for timber quality wood. So it is harvested unsustainably from natural forests. It's distributed in West, Central, and East Africa. Here's a black rectangle. And a group of a dozen scientists got together and they actually sampled a reference data set for these two species. It's about over 400 samples. They analyzed four marker systems, resulting in a total of something like 100 markers, genetic markers. And then they optimized their population model and used different parameter settings. And we are going to concentrate here on the best solution that they found. And basically this rectangle here is the black one over here. So the resolution is, so they found population structure, clear clusters. So it's the populations and the species from West Africa can be distinguished from those populations in Central Africa, and the ones on the east, in East Africa, can be differentiated. So that is really good. So we have population structure. We know their signal. The problem is still that our resolution is much lower than we would need to have it, because we basically need resolution on a, at least on a country level, because most of the legal, most of the laws are national, so might be legal to harvest a tree in one country, but not in another country. So we need to get our resolution down to country level or even to regional level if we want to distinguish was the tree harvested in a national park, in a protected area, or in outside in a managed forest. And when, as biodiversity scientists, we don't know how to continue, one thing is to look for what people do with model organisms, and specifically what people do in human population genomics, because there are thousands of population geneticists are working, and there's a completely different funding background due to the interest of the medical and the pharma industry. So they are always advanced. What we can learn from there, from results in, from human population genomics, is that we need two features. One is, we already know that, we need a distribution-wide sampling, which provides a spatial context. The second feature is that we need genome-wide sequencing, preferably genome sequencing, which provides us depth in time. Because our genomes are archives of our evolutionary history. They're records of all the processes and events. And this steps in time then translates also into resolution. Once we have these two features, actually, these reference data sets open Pandora's box. Certainly, we can ask all kinds of questions and objectives, even those that we still don't know. We can develop all kinds of applications, which is done for humans. Currently, there are at least four global data sets on human human diversity. These are very widely reused. And these big data data sets, so they are big data with regard to the number of samples and also the genomes or the genome representations, and this results in very information-rich data, which initiates analytical development. So people continuously developing new statistical methods, and right now a new wave is coming in of these methods. So once you have these global data sets, people start in human population genomics, they start to do these intense regional samplings. And this is the example of the United Kingdom Biobank. It's a project with 500 volunteers. They are all UK citizens from all over the islands. And each individual was genotyped in a wet lab for 820 markers. That's completely, that's a different number than the 100 or 1,000, or in biodiversity science, it's most, we normally analyze a maximum of a couple of 10,000 markers. So that's a completely different number. But then statistical geneticists come, they do some weird and wonderful voodoo, and they derive 96 million markers per genome, that is per individual, from these 820 markers that were produced in the lab. So that's a 100-fold increase. And once you have this kind of data set for a genome, you become country level and within country level resolution. So these panels are examples. So the first panel shows individuals who were born in Edinburgh. And the question was, where were people born who had a similar ancestral background, genetic background? And what they found was that was all over Scotland and Northern Ireland. Northern Yorkshire was even more local, so people from Yorkshire don't seem to get around a lot. For London, the situation is completely different. That is what we would expect, because London is a people magnet. People move there all the time. They meet there, they become children, and the kids born in London, their genetic ancestry has nothing to do with London. It's from all over the place, from the British Isles and the world. So that's why the colors are very strongly dissolved. So this study came out also this summer, and it's the first time that I have seen that we actually really can achieve regional resolution. And I find this possibility for biodiversity science very exciting. So it was made possible by very sophisticated statistical approaches, which are able to analyze genetic data from highly complex evolutionary and ecological systems. And at the same time, these analyses are able to handle big data. We are talking about gigabytes and terabytes of data and results. Statistical geneticists, they're developing new methods of data representation to handle this amount of data. And then we are able to sufficiently extract the signal for a very specific question from data, which is a very low signal to noise ratio. So to get there, we need many experts and specialists. So we need statistical geneticists, big data experts who also might contribute machine learning expertise. We need molecular biologists who know how to sequence complex genomes. We need bioinformaticians with an expertise in genomics for assembly, annotation, and alignment of genomic sequences. The result is actually this. This is the author list for the Thousand Genomes Project reference data set. And I don't expect you to be able to read it, but the bold type is of interest because it shows all the different tasks that are necessary to produce a standardized and highly cleaned reference data set. So the whole author list is something like 1.5 pages long, and even considering that some authors will have contributed to several tasks, the publications for reference data sets mostly have author lists that are far over 50 people. So they are huge collaborative efforts. Now we take the step into biodiversity science. Here, these are 8 gastrotrichs. They are little worm-like organisms who live in the sediments of freshwater lakes and marine sediments. They're in general a couple of hundreds micrometers large. And I don't have any numbers, but my guess would be that maybe worldwide 100 to 1,000 people actually work on these species. There are 800 species of gastrotrichs. So let's say there's 1 to maybe 3 experts per species for these organisms. So how are these 3 people going to manage all these tasks to produce a reference data set? You might say, well, it's gastrotrichs. I mean, have never heard about them. Maybe they are not so important. Maybe you don't need the reference data sets. But actually, some of those species are bioindicators for water quality. So what we observe right now is a gap for biodiversity conservation. In model organisms, we have Pandora's box open. We have all the statistical analysis at our hands to analyze our data sets. However, in non-model organisms, we are still stuck with summary statistics that don't provide us the resolution that we need. And we know that to close this gap, even for a single species, it's a huge effort. But at the same time, we have over 35,000 species listed by CITES, which need already now effective protection. So we need to find a way to close this gap and actually move in this direction. And the good thing is, all of this in biodiversity sciences, in academia, and we need to make the transition over the conservation genomic gap into the big loop of real-world conservation tasks. And the good thing is we already know what we have to do, so we need to have reference data sets distribution range-wide, we need to have statistics, and it's going to be big data, so we need collection management, data management, and an analysis environment. So looking at the different ingredients or different steps, first we need a general data infrastructure for global diversity reference data sets that actually can be used across species for preferably as many species as possible and provide a working environment for biodiversity scientists and experts. Should be user-friendly, so it can be used by scientists, but also that people from local communities and citizen scientists can add their observation data and their data into this data infrastructure. I have listed quite a lot of features that these kind of infrastructures should have, and I'm going to argue that these features are not some nice to have, but actually some must have. Because our goal is always application. So we need developers, managers, and curators for data infrastructures. Since our goal is application, the main results we need, so our main features are quality control and error reduction. These are the basis so that our conservation tools can be robustly and reliably applied under real-world operating conditions. And the way to achieve quality and error reduction is through chains of custody. So it means that from project design, from the questions, through all the steps that are necessary to produce a reference data set, and then sample collection, genomics, statistical analysis, down to application, these steps need to be documented, standardized. Each one of them needs to be validated and reproducible. They should be modular, so they can be user-friendly, and the whole chain of custody needs to be scalable. If our chains of custody have these characteristics, we actually will have tools that will work in everyday life. So we need professional developers and programmers who are able to produce these very collaborative softwares. We need free and open source experts. So we always can ensure that our code and that our infrastructures are still integer, and we can check them. And I'm a biologist. I don't have any background in hardware, but I've heard a couple of talks here on the conference about green IT, and have the feeling we should have people who know hardware and software and know how to develop these high-tech tools in a way sustainable, so that by developing these tools we don't use more resources than we are trying to protect. So I've shown all these features and characteristics that the software should have, and I'm arguing that these features are necessary because of the reality we find us in. It's one of rising over-exploitation and destruction of nature. So the extent of environmental crimes is up in the billions. It's all environmental crime together, the green bubbles, are only second to drug-associated crimes. And they are up there with counterfeiting, human trafficking. So these are multi-billion enterprises. They are often transnational and, industries with huge profits. So if there's some crime, some mafia boss, some criminal manager who just bribed a government official somewhere in the neck in the woods, it just would make sense that that person would not wait or not take the risk to be discovered just because some customs officer pulls out a container somewhere in a harbor, for example, opens it and says, this looks kind of weird. Let's take a sample, send it to a lab, and then a population geneticist comes back and says, this sample is not from area A as documented, but actually it's from area B and it was illegally logged. So if we have reference data sets, information-rich reference data sets, they become highly valuable and they need protection themselves against manipulation and destruction. So We will need to think about IT security from the beginning. Also, these data sets are often very politically sensitive, because if it is shown that in a certain country there is illegal logging repeatedly, that country might not be too excited about this information. So we need to think about IT security experts. So my hope is that these kind of very high-tech digital conservation tools can actually contribute to the UN Sustainable Development Goals by empowering indigenous people, local communities, and also us to protect, enforce, and sustainably use our lands and our biodiversity by providing the management and law enforcement tools. So we need people from around the world, users from around the world, who use these tools and help to develop them further and to maintain them. And finally, these high-tech tools will be just another technological fix if we don't manage to get our back down, our way of life down to sustainable levels. So what we need is to, today, this year, the Earth Overshoot Day was at the end of July. So at the end of July, we had used all the resources that we had available for the whole year. And we need to get this back towards the end of the year so that our resources actually sustain us for the whole year. And yeah, the graphic here for Germany suggests that we are on a good way. We are reducing our resource consumption, and maybe even our biocapacity moves up a little bit. So it seems that our personal lifestyles and choices make a difference, and we just need to close this gap here much quicker. So protecting biodiversity needs all of us to achieve that. And with that, thank you very much.
So thank you, Jutta, for this very interesting talk and the very valuable work you're doing. We have three mics here. Please line up at the microphones if you have any questions or suggestions or want to participate and work together with Jutta. Okay. We have one question from the internet, so please, our signal angel, start.
Why do wild plant species within a genus are further apart than wild animal species within a genus?
Could you repeat it, please?
Yeah. Why do wild plant species within a genus are further apart than wild animal species within a genus?
I'm not sure I understand the background for the questions.
Because animals move and plants don't move.
Oh, okay. So if that is the idea behind the question, plants actually move too. They don't move as individuals, but they move the genetic material through pollen or fragments. So actually, diversity in plants and in animals can be quite similar. So the idea that plants are just stuck and should have a completely different population structure does not hold, because plants move around their genetic material through seeds, through pollen, through vegetative propagules.
So thank you, microphone one, for helping out. Please ask your question.
So my question is a bit about the success factor. If we think of this, whatever database being set up there, and I think it's going to be a huge database, I downloaded my own genome on the internet. It was about 150 megabytes. And if we multiply that, I think the genetic variation from one person to another is about 1% only. So we have, we can compress that to 4 megabytes per person. If we sequence all the humans in the world, that would be 32 petabytes. That would cost approximately $15 billion. And that's only for the storage. Now comes the entire management. Of course, we don't want to digitize all the human genome, but rather the plants and animal species genome. So it's a huge data program. And what would be for you the success factors for this thing to really fly? And did you talk to organizations like Wikidata or others, or where would it ideally be hosted? At a university or an international nonprofit, or who would be running the thing?
Yeah, I mean, it is really big data, and I mean, I think the first goal is not to think about having all predicted 5 to 10 million species be sequenced on a population level. I think we need to think about the next step, and would make sense to start with species that are actually highly exploited, like many timber species and also many marine fishes. And I think that's where we should start. And to host this kind of data, I think it should be in political independent hands. So it should be with an NGO or with the UN, some organization that is independent. And
are you the first to think about this, or are there existing initiatives?
There are actually existing initiatives. I have been in contact with the Forest Stewardship Council, and they are actually starting to sample their concessions and initiated to build up the samples. They work together with Kew Botanical Gardens and the U.S. Forest Service. Right now they're analyzing the samples using isotopes with another method, which is very powerful and can also produce geographic information. And so people are moving in this way. I think the idea is out there. It's just we have to start and we have to really do it and provide one infrastructure so that we can combine, for example, morphological data, isotope data, and genomic data into one data set, which will increase our resolution and our reliability.
Yeah. Okay, microphone number 2, please.
Thank you for your valuable talk. My question would be, you started your talk with the possible decrease of leaf beetles, and in the data set you showed on slide number 6, there was an increase in leaf beetle population until the 70s, something about that. Is there a possible explanation for that?
I believe it is because people started to much more systematically observe leaf beetles, so it's a sample effort. And also, at that time, the people, so it's a multi-people collaboration who actually has assembled this data set. So the people who are part of this collaboration, they added their own private data sets, and that's why you have an increase, I think. While the people from the 1900s, 1910, you only can use the data that is available in publications and samples in museums or in scientific collections. I think that is the reason why you have the sharp increase.
Okay. Thank you.
So we have another question at microphone number 2.
Thank you for your fine talk. And excuse me, maybe my question is a bit off topic. Do you think the methods and the roles that you identified in your talk could be transferred to the assessment of raw materials? I'm thinking about metals.
maybe the data infrastructure, like if you wanted to collect raw metals or materials from all over the world and assemble a scientific collection and have kind of a reference data set, that might work, actually. But the genomics obviously won't. So that part wouldn't. Yes, and you would need to use different methods from physics, obviously. But actually, the infrastructure, certain parts will be quite similar. I think so, yes.
So we have one more question from the internet.
Who does contract a freelance evolutionary biologist? Can you give an example of this kind of work you proposed?
So I see this gap between science and applications, that we need these applications, and there's a huge potential for these applications. We know that illegal logging, that is my background, but it doesn't seem to be much different, for example, in marine fisheries. We know that there's this huge amount of illegal logging and timber trade going on, and we need to have the methods actually that are have the power to detect illegally traded timber. So I think there's a huge need for these kind of methods, and organizations who are interested in these kind of methods are governments, they're companies, NGOs, customs, Interpol. So, yeah.
Do we have any other questions? So thank you again, Jutta, for your talk and the valuable work you're doing. Please give a warm round of applause to Jutta.